Hi, I'm Frances Fry.
And I'm Ann Morris.
And we are the hosts of a new TED podcast called Fixable.
We've helped leaders at some of the world's most competitive companies solve all kinds of problems.
On our show, we'll pull back the curtain and give you the type of honest, unfiltered advice we usually reserve for top executives.
Maybe you have a coworker with boundary issues, or you want to know how to inspire and motivate your team.
Give us a call, and we'll help you solve the problems you're stuck on.
Find Fixable wherever you listen.
Despite what people think, supply chain were not broken during the pandemic. In fact, supply chain managers should all get recognition for keeping people working in this time and getting things moving.
The COVID-19 pandemic made all of us interested observers of supply chains. UF industrial policy, with its emphasis on reshoring and sourcing, has kept the topic front and center. The influence of artificial intelligence completes a trifecta of sorts, but the logistical, economic, and geopolitical complexities involved defy armchair expertise. Welcome to the Managing the Future of Work podcast from Harvard Business School. I'm your host, Harvard Business School professor and non-resident senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, Joe Fuller. My guest today is Yossi Sheffi, director of the MIT Center for Transportation and Logistics. Professor Sheffi's wide-ranging research spans supply chains, transportation, organizational management, and the business and regulatory impacts of advances in engineering. His latest book is The Magic Conveyor Belt, Supply Chains, AI, and the Future of Work. In it, he deconstructs supply chains and examines the role of advanced technologies like AI and robotics, including how they are likely to change the work humans perform. We'll talk about what, contrary to most of the media coverage, COVID-19 actually revealed about global supply chains. We'll also consider whether the U.S. is on the brink of a domestic manufacturing renaissance and the hard choices that would entail. We'll also parse the workforce and educational implications of artificial intelligence. Well, Yossi, welcome to the Managing the Future of Work podcast.
Thank you very much for having me. Happy to be here.
Yossi, as I've followed your work over the years, one of the things I found most impressive about it is its breadth. You commented on multiple major phenomena in engineering, how that applies to business, how regulators should think about it. Tell us a little bit about your journey and what's given you this great purview across so many important topics.
Well, number one thing is getting old. I have many years to cover enough topic. Another thing is just innate curiosity. My research area cover many areas and many subjects. To put it the way my wife likes to put it, I get bored easily. I like to dive into new area, to dive into new field. That's what keeps me going.
One constant going back to your earliest work and where I first noticed you when I was a CEO in the consulting industry is your deep study of complex supply chains, global supply chains. That was obviously a major topic during COVID. We saw both grave shortages, frightening shortages. We saw what had been a very stable system have a lot of turbulence introduced to it. And you know, systems, once you introduce turbulence to them, are hard to get back into equilibrium, especially when they are complex with tightly coupled properties. So what are your observations about what we learned from COVID about supply chains? And what do you think are the issues going forward, particularly as we see a little bit of revisitation of the kind of Washington consensus of widespread global trade?
One of the reasons I wrote my latest book is that I tried to get people to understand what supply chain are about, because it is a very complex system, and try to explain to people that once they understand what it takes, they are not going to be unhappy when a product does not make it to the supermarket shelf or to the Amazon warehouse. In fact, they're going to be amazed and thankful when it does. Because once you understand the journey from raw material through many countries, many tax regime, many customs regime, going back and forth, you understand what it takes to get a sophisticated product to market. You're just amazed that it's actually happened. So I try to get people to, in many ways, appreciate the fact that I thought, despite what people think, supply chain were not broken during the pandemic. In fact, supply chain managers should all get recognition for keeping people working in this time and getting things moving. Let me just say that people panic. The main reason to panic was the media, was an amplifier of small things to make them big things. That's lack of understanding and context. The New York Times admitted that until the pandemic, until the middle of the pandemic, they did not have any reporter covering the beat of supply chain and logistics. The Wall Street Journal had several people.
Well, certainly we did have all sorts of traditional lines of demarcations between issues erased in what was a global emergency. I think one thing that is redolent in your work is that these are systems. And most human beings, certainly most correspondents for periodicals, are not really systems thinkers like policymakers. When they're trying to get some specific outcome, very often miss the point of a system's effects and how they might, in fact, get perverse outcomes or unintended consequences. When we think about supply chains in the future, what are the most important attributes you think people that are trying to get a better understanding of supply chain and how they affect business outcomes, social outcomes, and, you know, are there particular themes you think are underappreciated by decision makers?
Okay, so first of all, from the company's point of view, the two most important things are cost and level of service. During the pandemic, for example, we saw, because of the situation, costs were going up and there was shortages, the level of service. There was no availability there. Companies try to make sure that the product are always available at the lowest possible cost. Because of society's needs, two other issues came to the forefront, resilience and sustainability. I wrote a book about sustainability, Balancing Green, because sustainability is a supply chain phenomenon. Because a company, it's meaningless if they cut their emission, but a company in China who manufactured the stuff has owned the emissions. In fact, it is even worse than doing it in the United States, because at least here we have some environmental guardrail. So you have to look at the entire supply chain and judge a company by the operation of the supply chain. And that's, by the way, not easy at all, because supply chain are so complex. There are many, many tiers of production of raw material and parts and other parts and more parts and finally assembly. Most companies don't have any idea who the deep tier supplier in the supply chain are. So it's very hard for them to understand how to make them, say, more sustainable, how to make sure they don't go suddenly out of business, how to make sure they have continuity of supply. The big challenge is we go possibly into a recession, who knows, but we go into any other disruption, is actually to keep eyes on the ball in terms of long term, to keep, for example, on sustainability, while people are worried about cost. Europe is already getting into a recession, and you see even in Europe, suddenly gas is a green fuel. So that's an indication of people and politicians understanding what's important. Every politician in democratic society is short-term thinking. There's a reason the Chinese are not short-term thinking, because they live for the long term. They're not going to be thrown out if something goes wrong. So all these issues are adding to what supply chain managers have to contend with.
So one thing we've seen, as I alluded to earlier, as a result, probably initially because of COVID and COVID revealing that, for example, a vast, vast majority of the basic chemicals in antibiotics are made in China. The vast, vast majority of personal protective equipment is made in China. That the vast majority of rare earths are mined in China. So that across multiple sectors, this growing complex global supply chain that had emerged since the mid-1990s had some perverse effects, and that we started hearing about reshoring, which is something I must admit I've talked to a lot of people about. I haven't witnessed a lot of it happening, but I'm interested in your commentary on that. But now we also have the beginning of the evolution of some industrial policies, which is an idea that has been bandied about for 40 years, 50 years that I can remember. And the WEFT, and particularly the United States, has always stepped back from it. But now, certainly with the CHIPS Act and the Inflation Reduction Act, with the green massive subsidies for green, we seem to be heading in that direction. What are your views of this effort to test decoupling some of the global system, maybe moving to more trading blocks? And what's the plausibility of actually seeing a lot of change given this binary set of considerations that you just posed about the security resilience of the supply chain, but also the cost per unit?
The answer is that it is not going to really happen. The reason is, let's unpick several of the things that you were talking about. Leaving China, which is what most policymakers are worried about, is something that cannot be done in anything less than decades. Companies invested decades and billions of dollars in not building, not just getting material in China, not just getting low labor in China. In fact, China is not anymore, in the industrial centers of China, labor costs are getting to be pretty high. But China became a sophisticated manufacturer, an innovative manufacturer of a lot of product. People were arguing with this, but I would argue that in electric vehicles, they are now close to leading the pack. There are many, many areas that are just sophisticated military supply, but also things like textile manufacturing, robotics, and others. So people invested decades in China. Of course, China always helped themselves with all the contracts that you have to come here. You want to sell in China, you have to make in China. And by the way, give us your recipe for the product you make. And most companies succumbed to this and did it. But now, in many ways, it's too late. The Chinese are already there. They are anchored in our supply chain systems. But they are anchored not only in terms of they have the mineral and rare earth minerals. For example, aluminum. China is one of the largest manufacturers of the world in aluminum. So you can say, okay, we can get aluminum from Australia too. There are other places you can get. We can actually mine it in the United States if we really want to. But most of the smelters in the world, the best one are in China. I mean, they build their whole supply chain for the aluminum. When people talk about reshoring, first of all, they think about taking the final process, the assembly, out of China. But the whole supply chain is still in China. And even if we'll be somewhat successful in this, it means that we will regionalize, which means we restrict our markets too, because other people will do it as well. And everybody will start closing the market, which means everybody's losing scales. Cost is going to go up. Inflation is going to rear its ugly head again. All of these things are not well thought out. I mean, the Infrastructure Act, which is another way of helping the United States. But there are so many things that are missing. For example, TSMC, building a chip plant in the United States, announced that making chips in the United States, even if we have all the material, is going to cost 50% more than in Taiwan. Why? Because they have to train engineers. They say, we don't have enough trained engineer to do sophisticated. Those guys make the most sophisticated chips in the world. And they know that when trained these engineers, Intel and NVIDIA and everybody else will steal them. So they have continuously trained engineers. They understand this. And then, with raw materials, we want to balance sustainability with, say, security, because the issue of raw material, they also go into military jets. Right? It's issue of security. So I want security. I want clean air and clean water. But I'm not willing to completely sacrifice one for the other. So we have to think about maybe opening some mines in the United States, because we know they're going to be better anyway than the mines in China. So we should do it. We cannot let Europe freeze when they don't have Russian gas. If we don't allow fracking gas, which is now they consider grid energy, we put our allies into trouble who may turn to other sources. It's exactly the point that you mentioned before, system thinking. You cannot think about the environment or security, or resilience, or cost, or service independently. They are all connected to each other, and there's trade-off between them.
Well, it's a very interesting dilemma on twofold. One is, of course, the way most government bureaucracies organize responsibilities for different parts of the system. Something else you raised, which I think is very interesting, is this notion of the relative merits of a supply chain versus its absolute merits. So we can say we don't want to mine rare earths in Wyoming because mining rare earths is environmentally problematic. But if you're going to allow the Chinese to mine them in a much less responsible way, are you not just fooling yourself? And I think...
And creating dependence of China in the same
And creating...
So it's a bit on both accounts. But you're right. The way government is organized, the way many part of societies are organized, this is what, by the way, attracted me to supply chain in business, because it kind of cuts across. When you're in supply chain, you need to understand marketing and sale and finance and procurement. You need to understand how the company operates. And not only this, you need to understand your customers. You need to understand suppliers and their supplier and their suppliers. It's a very complex and a big system working over multiple countries and regimes and cultures. I always tell my friends, supply chain is life. It's complex and frustrating, you know, all of the above.
As someone who thinks systemically and broadly about these issues, how are you thinking about the application of AI? Where do you think it's going to be most relevant, particularly in problem solving the type of systemic problems that we've been talking about?
There is, of course, understandable fear among professionals who, after ChatGPT came out, that it starts obviating a lot of white-collar work. I was talking to people in tech who are worried about the computer programming jobs. Who needs us, or who needs us as writing books, or who needs us to write, you know, media, who needs to us to do TV programming. First of all, it's very hard to predict. And when it's very hard, we go to the past, we go to history. Every forecasting is based on history. And if we look at the four industrial revolution that preceded today, every one of this had fear that jobs are going to disappear, and every one of these created a lot more jobs than jobs disappear. So, first of all, this should be some comfort. By the way, let me mention that in every one of those, people say, but this time is different. So, it's also a common phrase. Another thing, it takes a long time. Job changes. Some jobs are being lost. We don't have any more elevator operator or telephone exchange operators. Computer used to be a job, you know, not just a device. But it takes a long time for this to change, because these are company processes, government processes. Several examples. I mean, one example is, let's say, AT&T in 1892 invented the automatic telephone exchange. 1950, there were still 350,000 telephone operators in the United States. Only by 1980, 9 decades later, it started to disappear. So it takes time, taking it in embedding anything in process takes time. Second, there are unions, of course, always worried about jobs and try to slow down jobs with some success. And there is government regulation. We're talking now about AI. People are talking about, before you will be able to release code into the wild, you'll have to go to clinical trials to try it out, make sure that it works well and doesn't do what it's not supposed to do. And finally, there's social acceptability. Not too many people would be totally comfortable with seeing autonomous trucks run at 100 miles per hour on the freeway behind them with no driver. We'll see. It may come, but it will take time. Some jobs will disappear, but mostly jobs will change. The main challenge for companies, for government, for society in general, is how to integrate people with AI. The example of people in the loop, when you go into Amazon warehouse, the whole aisle moves to the person does something, it moves on. The person and the machine are in the loop, working together. There are cases when the person is operating, you know, when you have an automotive plant, you have people with iPad-like devices who operate the robots. So there's a many, many cases when people monitor and get involved just when something goes bad or people are part of the process. Another area is when the robot does this, a variation of this, when robot does the simple jobs. So, for example, when I talk to computer programmers who are worried about, so they tell me, look, the veteran computer scientists are not worried about this because they have so much knowledge. It's the junior ones who are a problem. Their job can be automated. I'm saying, let me think. How do you think we're going to grow veteran computer programmers? They have to start as junior computer programmers. They have to learn the ropes. They have to learn how to do it. They have to gain experience. Otherwise, you are not going to have senior ones. And as long as lifespan of human is limited, you need a constant flow of people. So that's another challenge. How do you get people with 5 years of experience or 10 years of experience in every job? Finally, let me just say that it is impossible to imagine all the new jobs that are being that will be created. Ford created the assembly line, which changes manufacturing fundamentally. Instead of a group of artisans basically building a car, the car moved along the assembly line and each person was putting doing just a limited part. What happened is Ford employment went from about a few thousand to 150,000 during the heyday of the Model T production. So people think, oh, we got more jobs. This was the smallest part of the effect. Cars became a lot less expensive. People could afford them. And now they wanted to travel. So we built freeway, we built hotels, motel, restaurant. The whole hospitality industry with millions of jobs developed. This was not what Henry Ford was trying to do. But there's kind of unexpected consequences. So it's very hard to imagine. And the anxiety comes because we know the people are going to lose their job or the job is going to change because they are the people that we work with. They are our friends, our neighbors, the people that we see every day. And we can see the people at the supermarket who may lose their job. What we don't see is all the new industry because they don't exist yet. Or the new jobs that don't exist yet.
Well, one thing that's encouraging about this, certainly in our research and our Managing the Future Work project, is of course AI has the possibility of replacing really tasks done within jobs. And many of the tasks that will be replaced are tasks that can be described as dull, white collar routine work where you're creating the monthly report, you're creating the monthly forecast, you're creating a summary of the press clippings about the company, that all of those things are highly addressable by existing level AI with the right prompt engineering. And what it'll free those white collar workers to do, first of all, to be more productive. And productivity, at least the way we've measured it in the US, has been pretty unimpressive in its growth in recent years. But also it will allow those people to spend more time doing more creative work, more interpersonal work, and just having more fulfilling careers. We used to think about automation replacing the so-called dirty, dark, dangerous jobs. We could add the fourth D of dull. Now, that might be a little bit frightening because white-collar workers will be more exposed to the advent of AI than they have been to previous cycles of innovation, which means it's not just the clerk at the grocery store, but it's also people down the hall from us or floors from us or us. That brings me to an interesting question, because here at Harvard Business School, we've been investigating AI relative to its capacity to analyze the case studies we use in our Socratic teaching method. I've been using it to get extensive commentary on research vectors I'm thinking about pursuing in our future of work analyses, since it can read every paper ever written on labor economics if it so chooses. How do you see AI affecting universities, affecting the way we teach, the research we do, the way we want to capture and propagate knowledge?
Okay, so let me start by being a little provocative. One of the things that one of the debates in many universities is on a lower level, do we allow students to use ChatGPT to write article, project reports, what have you? Because people say, oh, they never learn how to write. They don't know how to put two sentences together. My answer to this, and I think I started thinking about this, when I was in school, they taught me how to take square roots by hand. Nobody is teaching you anybody today how to take a square root, how to do the calculation by hand. It's really not necessary. Would we get to the point that it's not necessary to write? That writing will be, who needs it? As long as you can read, as long as you can develop the critical thinking that allows you to judge what you read and to see if it's ChatGPT hallucinating or it's being able to critically read. That will be the most important thing taught in school. I'm thinking always about, you know, driving cars, you know, there's a mechanic and a driver. The driver doesn't have to know how the machine works, just has to use it. In terms of using it in education, can certainly use it for exactly the type of thing that you mentioned, preparing class notes, preparing even class syllabus. We have a huge online program that just had in November, we had the 1 millionth registrant on in supply chain. So it's very successful, and we use a lot of AI to analyze. For example, when this was developed before ChatGPT, this is just standard machine learning, you might call it, before large language model, in order to find out when do people are going to drop the course, to see the warning sign before they drop the course, so we can intervene, to see the warning sign when they start having difficulty. Honestly, that's much easier online, because in online, you have a record of every click that they do, and you can have unbelievable data. Now, what you don't have is looking at the face of somebody, which you can do in class and say, okay, that person is in trouble. But you can do it actually pretty successfully. We were very successful success almost 100% in identifying the people who may drop out, not 100% in convincing them not to drop out. This was about 50% or so. But identifying is usually the most important part. You know, intervening, okay, we can intervene digitally, we intervene, you know, interviewing with them, talk to them, try to see what's going on and try to help.
Well, it strikes me that there may be some exciting opportunities, particularly as the very impressive rate of learning in the generative AI systems that you could get patterns where the AI is able to deduce more rapidly than the instructor what it is about a concept an individual student isn't grasping, or, you know, what are inferences or arguments that a researcher may be unaware of that are in an adjacent but relevant topic, and the prospect of making both learning and the generation of knowledge more efficient and more systematic, to go back to a concept we touched on, might be something we can look forward to.
And we do it. We do it already, but we do it on the online because of the richness of data. So, for example, we give problem sets, students have to solve problems. Automatically, if they solve and there's certain errors, we know that they should get another problem of that kind, of different kind. In many cases, we just try to walk the students to a problem set and get them to the answer rather than give them the answer. But this is now being done through large language models. Or we were in the process of doing it with large language models.
Yossi, I've been so grateful for the breadth and vision of your work. Where are you heading next? What is it, with this restless mind of yours that doesn't like being bored, what is the next glittering distraction you think you might focus on?
Well, I'm trying to ask ChatGPT, where should I go? I think that I'm still going to keep taxon and development of the how people get human and AI fused algorithm to work together. The feel is that there's a fundamental change maybe going on. And I'm trying to keep on top of this to be part of it, to see how it's working, to document it, to do all the things, how it affects supply chain in particular, but in general, as we say, supply chain is life, so how it affects everything.
The emergence of more what some people have called bionic jobs, a blend of biological talent and technological talent, and it, you know, is certainly going to be a principal theme in our research. Always a pleasure to hear from you, Yossi, and hear about your thinking about current events, the economy, technology, and very anxious to see what emerges from your restless mind going forward. Professor Yossi Sheffy of MIT and the head of the Center for Transportation and Logistics, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Appreciated it.
We hope you enjoy the Managing the Future of Work podcast. If you haven't already, please subscribe and rate the show wherever you listen to podcasts. You can find out more about the Managing the Future of Work project at our website, hbs.edu/Managing the Future of Work. While you're there, sign up for our newsletter.